All right, so we are good to go. So this is James Newberry, and I'm here with Justin Davis on Wednesday, June 16th, 2021 at the KSU Center at Kennesaw State. And I want to thank you for sitting down with me and making the trip. And do you agree to the interview?
I do.
Great. So can you tell me your full name?
My name is Justin Jared Davis.
And what's your birth date?
I was born June 12, 1987 at R.T. Jones Regional Hospital in Canton, Georgia.
So happy late birthday.
Well, thank you.
I know it was your birthday the other day when we saw each other, or right around that time. You said you were born at the hospital. That's Northside now?
Yes.
And can you tell me, you know, after you were born, Justin, what are your earliest memories growing up?
I just remember my mom, she was young when she had me, so she was like we talked about with the picture, she was a junior in high school, and so my grandmother, great-grandmother, was still working, but she had just retired and stopped. She worked at people's houses, and so she kept me, so my mom finished school, and she started working at a local daycare center, and I didn't want to go, so I stayed with my grandmother, and my earliest memories are just being at home with her and just playing with the neighborhood kids. We lived in an apartment complex in Tate, and I just remember her stories and her singing old spirituals and singing old, you know, songs and telling the stories of her childhood. She was from Washington County, Sandersville, and so I just remember those early stories about life and on the farm and things like her early memories of, she'd show us on her knees where they were down picking cotton and what that included, and yeah, that's been.
What was your great-grandmother's name?
Her name was Ruby Hampton, Ruby Dawson Hampton, and she passed away in 2002. She was like 91, 92.
How did she end up in Pickens County?
She came with my great-grandpa, Jewel Hampton. Actually, I have some pictures of, I had one picture of him, now I've got a picture of both of them. And they came to work in, he came to work at the Georgia Marble Quarry.
What job did he do?
He worked for, I've heard people say different names. I've never really known what the real name of it is. They describe it as a gatter or Gatlin or something like that, and some big machine, and because he was about, I think he was between maybe 6'5 and 6'7, so he was and she was like maybe 5 foot at most, maybe 98 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah.
So do you have any idea how they heard about, or how he heard about the job?
Well, for years they had been, people had been coming from South Georgia, well, middle Georgia really, to work in the quarry. They would send, they said Colonel Sam would send people down to different places, especially down, I think it was because there was a mining down there too. It was Kaolin, and my grandma called it the chalk mines.
Yeah.
And the different uses they used it for. She's like, we even made paint, we paint the inside of the house. And so I think that's why he sent people down there to recruit. And they moved their whole family. She said they moved, I think my grandma was born. There were three children at the time, and they moved to Tate, to one of the company homes. I think she said it was three rooms or maybe four room house. And so I guess a kitchen, living area, and maybe two bedrooms.
And what community was that?
It's right in, down in Smoky Hollow, the actual hollow, kind of in the, I guess, the valley, I guess, down there.
I see. So I want to get deep into that shortly, but to sort of come back to your immediate family, what is your mother's name?
My mother's name is Tara Davis.
Okay, and what did she do for a living?
Well, my mother, she's always worked in retail. She, after I was born, she worked for the daycare center. I think she was going toward working in education, but then she just maybe decided not to because they closed the, it was a county, I think it was a state-funded daycare, and they closed it. And then after that, she started, because I even remember going with her to some, like, of the classes they would have to take to be certified to work in the daycare. And I think she even was certified to maybe be a substitute also, but her and the lady that the head of the Pickens County Daycare would actually go to places. I'd go with them, and she was a friend of the family, and she was actually, we had talked about the Collins family, we actually ended up renting a house from her, Emma Julia Collins, Washington. And then after that, she worked in retail. She worked at they just built the Ingalls in Jasper, and she worked there for several years and was the manager of the bakery. And then from there, she worked a little bit in Atlanta at the Harris Teeter and the Publix off just over here off of Wade Green. But basically, just in retail, she worked at Racetrack gas stations for about 10 years. And now she works part-time again at Ingalls. And then her main job is at the Dollar General. She works for Dollar General.
Did she commute down to Wade Green?
I can't remember. Did she live down here at the time? I think she was commuting at the time.
Okay. And, thinking about your mom and maybe other folks that you've grown up around or that you know, maybe family members, what jobs have they done recently or since you've been growing up in Pickens County or elsewhere? Can you give me some examples, in addition to what you've just told me about your mom?
My great aunt, my grandmother's sister, lived with us. We lived with them and my great grandmother. And like I said, my great grandmother worked at people's homes for years and years and babysat their children. And she did that for many years. So I guess she was in her late 70s when I was born. So until then. And then my aunt worked, great aunt worked for the H.D. Lee Company, the Lee Company. Lee Jeans, it was the other big employer in Pickens County from like maybe the 50s and through like the 80s. And so they moved the company, so a lot of people lost jobs. And she worked for them, I think, pretty much until like right after high school. I think she started working for them until the late, maybe 90s, maybe 1990s when they moved once and then they came back. But the second time they closed the plant there. And she was seamstress in the at the Lee plant.
I see. So you were talking about growing up in Smoky Hollow, and it was an apartment complex?
Yes.
And is it still there?
Yes.
So could you sort of describe the area when you were growing up, how many houses were there versus now, if any have been demolished or fallen down?
Well, down in Smoky Hollow where the past the church where you drive down the hill, there were, I think there were maybe four houses still left, or maybe five or six. And then a couple people were allowed to bring double-wide trailers in, so there were a couple trailers down there. There's one still down there. And my grandma on my dad's side, they had lived in the apartments too after, and then they moved back down there and they took one of the houses that was still standing and they remodeled it, and they still actually live in it. My grandma passed away, but one of my aunts lives there, and we have family functions down there. It's right next to the church down there in Smoky Hollow. And I remember there were actually three houses across the street, and then there was a trailer, and then on the way up the hill there was another trailer and a house like way on the hill, like it was like in between kind of up where the Tri-City and, well, now Head Start is, and Smoky Hollow. And all since then, one by one, those houses have been demolished, and there's only one house. That's the house that my grandmother, my paternal grandmother, Ruby Stevens, had remodeled, and then one of the trailers is still down there. And then all the other houses in Smoky Hollow have been demolished. And there were some houses, I remember, near the school. There were about two or three left, and they've since been demolished. There was one across down the hill from Head Start, and it's been demolished. And there's a couple trailers that were out there, and I think one of them is still out there. And I think I couldn't live out there because it's so lonely out there. I think he's the only person that lives out there.
Yeah.
And it's like all of that is right above the marble quarry at church, Mount Calvary. If you just walk down the hill, it's the quarries are right there. And so, and the apartments they built in like maybe 1970, early 70s, and I think maybe they moved in like 1974, 75. My grandma and great grandma, they lived right next to each other. And and so, yeah, that's what I remember as far as housing. In the apartments, there were, we lived in a unit. They had three bedrooms. Some had, I think they had, we'd say there were four bedrooms, but it was just like it had a really big master bedroom and then two bedrooms upstairs and then one smaller bedroom downstairs. And then there were two bedroom units and then one bedroom unit. And they maintained them pretty well, you know. Wasn't like we were living in the slum, but it was, I think people just missed living, you know, being able to have their, you know, own yard,
right,
and, you know, have a house. And so
who was the owner, do you know?
It was the Jasper Housing Authority owned them.
I see.
They built them.
So you said that people were allowed to bring in mobile homes. Who allowed them to do that?
I believe it was the Tate Estates. I'm not sure because they own all of that land down there where our church is and where the Church of Smoky Hollow is, and even Tate United Methodist Church. They own all the land, and there's like I don't know if it's in writing. Maybe it is, just to make it legal, that as long as the church is being used as a church, they could still use the land and use the building. And if it ceases to be a church, the land will revert back to the Tate Estates.
Do you know when that arrangement was made?
I'm not sure. Sounds like it was made probably when, when the churches, maybe not when they were built, probably around the time when Sam Tate probably passed away, or sometime maybe before, when all the land was kind of in limbo and who the owners were and between his heirs. So I'm not exactly sure.
So sort of thinking about specifically the Black community and how much of that was owned, I mean, all of it, I guess, was owned by the company and then Tate Estates sort of as the successor to that. If homes fall down or have been demolished, I mean, I assume in most cases people have already moved out.
Yes.
Is there like the acceptance that, I mean, I'm moving away, so the owner, it remains Tate Estates, so that's left to them, whatever happens to the house or the space?
I would guess so, because I believe the house my grandmother remodeled, I believe it was just sitting there, and she worked for the company in the, I guess it's the, they called it the calcium division in Nelson, and where they refinished everything. She worked there for several years, and I think since she worked there, they gave her permission to go ahead and do that, just knowing that it's on our property and blah, blah, you know. And so she did all of that. And
that's your mother's grandmother?
No, it's my father.
Stevens,
yes.
And is she still living?
No, she passed away.
Okay, and she was working in Nelson. What was her job there?
I'm not exactly sure. But she was, that was the, I just remember seeing that on the sign that's there in Nelson when you drive into, I guess, downtown Nelson.
May I ask your dad's name?
His name is Bobby Stevens.
So it looks like then on both sides of your family, you had people in the marble industry.
Yes.
And, I mean, talk to me about the history of the Black community in relation to the marble industry. I mean, did anybody work outside of the marble industry that you know of? I mean, maybe people who worked in other people's homes or other types of jobs, maybe related to the railroad?
From what I gather from she was my great-grandmother's cousin. My great-grandmother's name was Frances Anderson Davis. You've seen pictures. Willie Mae Weaver.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I know a lot of the history. She said my great grandfather John Anderson, actually, he didn't work for the company, but he was a blacksmith. But I think because he was a blacksmith, they maybe let him. They lived somewhere maybe not in Smoky Hollow, but maybe across there was a, it could have been, it was all like, it just crossed 53 across from the Tate House. It was called Sandy Bottoms Road, and there was like a couple of more of the communities, like Lonesome, they called Lonesome City, and I can't think of the other names of the, but I think they might have lived over like in toward Lonesome City, and he was a blacksmith. So, but I don't think he was directly related to the company, and that's about the only person I've heard that didn't actually work at the company. And then my grandmother, great grandmother, his daughter, Frances Anderson Davis, she worked for, she actually was a part of the, I guess the housekeeping staff. I think she helped in the house at the Marble Mansion, at the Pink House. I've heard people call it that, Tate House, Pink House, but at the Tate House. And her husband, my great-grandfather, Harper Davis, he worked, I think he worked in the, for the company. Actually, I didn't know there was an article that my aunt, and I think, have you heard of, probably seen her name, Mimi Jo Butler?
Oh, yeah.
My great-grandmother Frances worked in their house, and so she, I guess they co-wrote a article about them, and she was saying that this man, I think it was like Beard and something, he had a farm close to their house, which their house, the Hill, they were Hills, Mr. Hill's house, Mrs. Hill's home is still off of 53, and there was a farm back there, and my grandfather was recruited to work in the marble mines by this guy, and he worked on his farm, Bearden, I can't think of his name. I just know it was Bearden, because I only read it like a couple days ago, and she was just talking about how they talked about my uncle and my aunt, and then my grandfather when they were born, and then another uncle, he was born when they were 50. My grandma was 50, and I guess my grandpa was probably like 60, 61.
She had him when she was
50? 50, yes.
Wow.
In the 50s.
Man, so he may still be living.
Well, he passed away a couple years ago.
Okay.
And his name was Barry Davis. He lived in Calhoun. And then my aunt, her name was Georgia Davis Cook. She was, unlike the rest of them, she didn't join. They had a joint revival between Mount Calvary Baptist Church and then the Church of Smoky Hollow, which no one ever knew the name, but I think Miss Weaver said it was called Mount Tabor. AME, we know it was AME, everybody doesn't think it was AME, they were like, no, because of this, no, it probably was AME because it was, I read somewhere that it had the same pastor as the AME church in Canton, St. Paul AME, which is still in existence, and so, but anyway, they had a joint revival, and she joined the AME church, and was Methodist, and actually now my cousin, Karen Cook, I don't know her, married name. They actually moved to Columbus, and that's where she met her husband, and they had my cousin Karen, and she's actually a Methodist pastor. Actually, she's in the, not AME denomination, she's in the United Methodist. She's a United Methodist pastor.
So, I want to talk more about the churches, specifically the two there, Mount Calvary and Miracle Fellowship. But can you tell me, the relative, I think it was Frances, who worked in the Pink House, did you ever talk to her about that? Did she discuss what she did or like specifically who she worked for? I mean, I know who lived there, but...
Right. I'm not sure because she passed away when I was maybe two or three, so I didn't get to talk to her, you know. And my mother and my uncles, they kind of listened. They weren't as inquisitive about history like I was, and so I just kind of absorbed it all, and so I'm not quite sure what she did at the Pink House.
I see. So let's move, you know, you talked about Smoky Hollow a good bit, and we'll talk more about it, and Lonesome City. Can you think of any other of the black communities and sort of their locations in and around the quarry?
Well, the Whippoorwill, that's where the school was. They had Upper Whippoorwill, I guess, because it was maybe up on the hill, then Lower Whippoorwill, which was closer to the quarries. And my grandma and grandpa, Laura Davis, well, Maddie Laura Davis and Clyde Davis Sr., they actually, she said that they lived in not Lonesome City, Whippoorwill, up, maybe it was Lower, well, in Whippoorwill, I don't remember if she said which one, and they were actually neighbors with, that would have been my grandpa's aunt and uncle, Miss Weaver, Willie Mae Weaver's parents there in Whippoorwill, and she talked about how in Smoky Hollow they had well water, but she said they thought they were big time because they had running water. It was close to the house, but they could just go out and turn on the faucet,
right,
the spigot or whatever you call it, and she said they even had a shower where they, you know, didn't have to draw water and bring it up to the house, and so she said they lived there the first part of their marriage, and that's where my Aunt Norma was born there, and then they moved to their house that they moved to in Smoky Hollow, which was one of those three houses I remember because my grandpa was still alive. I think he died the next year, so I remember him a little more. So I was like 4 or 5, and I remember going down to his house in Smoky Hollow. There were three houses. The one house where maybe he was, I think, grew up in, and then there was another house in between, then his house. And they're across the street from where my paternal grandma and family remodeled the house. But they lived there, and then that's where my mom and her other two brothers were. That's where they lived.
What kind of houses are these?
They were like the craftsman style, but I think they were kind of a maybe modified version, maybe. And I could see where somebody explained to me how, you know, they would come in the box and everything, and I think most of those houses down there were that maybe they weren't as fancy as maybe the houses over, like, on off Newtown Road and around the clinic and closer to Highway 5. But
those houses being white homes?
Yes.
Okay.
And I found out that at one time, I think it's in some of the history, that Smoky Hollow was built when people started moving here, that whites lived in Smoky Hollow. More whites lived in Smoky Hollow, and then the blacks lived. There's a community called, it was right behind Tate School and behind the church. I think that's where Mudhead Road, and they said actually blacks lived over there. And then at some point in the early 1900s, they kind of switched. And so, So I guess the houses were originally just built, you know, as houses for the workers, and they, you know, maybe not the, I think more of the maybe skilled laborers lived over in, off Newtown Road, where more the majority of the whites lived. But, you know, I just remember they were kind of like at my, the house that my grandma remodeled. They have like a living room. And then I think there are like two bedrooms, a kitchen. I think there's a dining room. And I think that was the basic setup for most of the houses. And I think some were larger, depending on the family size.
I see. So what can you sort of tell me about Colonel Sam Tate as you've heard about him, and especially in relation to black community? Because you've talked about him recruiting people from as far away as Sandersville. We have other stories that I'll ask about, like Forsyth, Forsyth County. But what can you tell me? What have you heard? What do you know?
Well, what I've heard is from talking with Mrs. Willie Mae Weaver and another lady that was everything in the church. You know, she was the Sunday school superintendent, had been a Sunday school teacher, and her family was from Lumpkin County. Her name was Hazel Clark Buck, and she would tell us about, but with the houses, she said some people, some of the houses were considered Georgia marble houses, and then some were Tate Estates, like they're, you know, and so that, I was like, okay, I guess I kind of get that. Yeah. And then they said that Sam Tate would always make sure that they had, like on 4th of July and maybe Labor Day, they would have big picnics at the school. And he'd make sure that they'd have a the meat, the barbecue was provided, and to the Masons, which actually they had a lodge, I think they were saying, at the, I know they were still one at Tate, the Marble Tate Elementary, but at their school, they called it Tate School too, but then at some point, I guess they start calling it Pickens County Training School because all of the other two, Tate and, I mean, Jasper Nelson schools consolidated with them. But just him being, making sure that they had teachers and that he was very, he picked the teachers himself and that he made sure they had a place to live and they would live with, they didn't necessarily have one house that was designated for teachers, but it kind of was like there were two boarding houses and the teachers lived there and they had, since I'm a musician, I know that she always said that they had a music teacher. And the other, you know, excuse me, and they had a big auditorium in the Pickens County Training School, or at the time Tate School, and he just made sure that they were taken care of, I guess. You know, his employees were taken care of, and that they had the same things, maybe not, you know, the same exact things or the same exact quality as his white employees, but they had the same things, you know, they were. Had school and they all knew who was the boss. They said they knew who was the boss, and I've heard a couple stories about they never mentioned any names. Of course, I wanted to know that if someone did something that was, you know, he considered immoral or, you know, or wrong, he would pack them up and send them back to wherever they were. He recruited them from.
Do you know examples of what was being done that was wrong?
Well, like I've heard that a lady had a baby out of wedlock. If any of the girls had a baby out of wedlock, they were shipped out, their whole family, them and their. Well, maybe just them, or but I've heard it was the whole family. They got shipped away back to wherever they were recruited from.
Do you know, or do you have any examples of the same being carried out with white employees?
No, not heard any. There probably may be some examples, but I'm not sure.
You know, there's a story that is told widely, at least by some of the folks we've worked with, that vigilantes or KKK members may have been planning to, like, drive black residents out, but Colonel Sam said no and stopped that. Do you know anything about that story?
I've heard that same story. I've read about it, you know, different articles, like in the Pickens Progress, and saying that he was, that they were headed toward Pickens County, and he said he'd put enough dynamite there. I guess there was a bridge between, I think they might have been coming from the Dawson County area between Marble Hill and, that's where I see Marble Hill and Pickens County and Dawson County, and said he was going to load the for lack of a word, the holler, or wherever the bridge was crossing, yeah. It was enough dynamite to just turn them into mincemeat. I think I read that somewhere. And so, and then I've heard that he sent to Atlanta for enough military rifles or rifles to help keep them off. And of course, they didn't come. And I've even read somewhere that he wanted to build like maybe a university or something in the area, and that possibly he wanted to build something equal for the blacks, and that's he didn't do it because it caused so much, you know, uproar. And so, but he said what he said went at the time. So
it you know, if you did what he said, then it would be relatively comfortable.
Yes.
But if not, you might be sent away.
Yes.
To where you came from.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk to me about the Collins family, specifically George Collins and then his son Olin Collins and their journey over? What can you tell me about that?
Well, from what I've read, well, actually, I actually worked on the land he bought in Jasper, I guess after he had, they moved from Tate in his later years, and I worked for his granddaughter. And from what I gather, that they that excuse me, his family, you know, they his maybe Olin Collins' grandmother had been enslaved for the Tate family, and because her, I think that's, I've read that in the Pickens County Heritage Book, and that they were working in Tate or lived somewhere in Pickens County. I believe it was, I actually looked at the census, maybe in the Talking Rock area. I think that's where a Collins family, maybe a white Collins family, lived. So they might have been, you know, associated with them somehow. But the mother, his grandmother, I think it was like Viola Tate, and so somehow I guess they ended up in Forsyth County. I think his oldest mother was from Forsyth County. I think I read that somewhere in that area. And I didn't find their family in the census. But they were in the 1910 census for Pickens County, though. So I don't know if they moved to Forsyth County, you know, and was, you know, just there at that time when all that was going on. But at some point, I've seen in recent things where it said that they didn't know where they had originated from, but they originated from Pickens County. And so I guess that's how they were able to get back to Pickens County. And I think the Tates knew there was a relation. And so that's how, I don't want to say that's how, they were probably, you know, very talented. They were, George Collins, I think he ended up working for the Tates, and they hired him on to work after they came back from Forsyth County. And I think his wife actually worked in the mansion. I think she might have been Miss Flora Tate's housekeeper or maid, personal maid. And then from there, they said, I think I read, I didn't know this, I just read that Olin Collins had like maybe a lung issue, so he couldn't work in the quarry. So there was a store in Smoky Hollow. There's actually a picture of me standing next to it, and I wish I knew where it was. I think somebody else had it of a stand, or maybe standing where it was. I don't know if it was still standing, but that was like the store that the community, black community, go buy anything. He had a barber shop in there. I think they could get anything except meat. I think the Tate Market that still there, it's like the three buildings. That was one with the post office, and the building in the middle was like the Piggly Wiggly or the grocery store for Tate, and they sold the meat, so they'd have to go there to get meat. And
from him at the stand?
Well, no, from the whoever owned the that Tate Market or whatever.
Oh, I see.
Or the Piggly Wiggly. I think it was eventually a Piggly Wiggly. And but they'd have to go there for meat. But the Collins family, everybody kind of revered them, and they were well respected. And they, I think they kind of were like a liaison between, you know, the black community and the Tates, along with the Roach family. And
so you talk about people revering them. That was true across the board, like black and white?
Well, I think so.
So I know one of the things that the reason I brought the Collins up, aside from wanting to learn all of that, was that that, you know, they needed a place to flee from Forsyth County, and Pickens was it. But as we've discovered in talking to you and in the research, is that they had a history there, like you said, and so it kind of made logical sense that that would be a place to return to, even if George's wife had been born in Forsyth County. So do you, I mean, do you know stories of other black families who migrated to Pickens from other places? You know, I know your family, you said, is Washington County, and then the Collins. Do you know of any other sort of stories like that?
Well, I wish I knew where this was. One evening I was reading about Pickens County history. I guess I was homesick or something. I was living in Savannah, and I read where it had some of the original, like, black families that didn't leave after slavery, and I think it was Collins family, then there was maybe the Langston family, and then the McClure family, so like Karen, Karen's family, Karen McClure Benson. And my other side, I guess on both sides of my family, I have family that, of course, came from Middle Georgia, from Washington County, Baldwin County, and Hancock County, I guess, too. And then, like the people, then there were people from Dahlonega. They would come from, walk over from Dahlonega to work in the marble quarries. And so that's where the Andersons I mentioned, that's where they're from. Andersons, Greens, that's my paternal. My dad's mom was a Green, and that's her dad was born over in Dahlonega area. And they would, like I said, they would walk on Sunday evenings before, I guess this was before they officially moved to Tate to come work. I think they would stay in a boarding house. And so from the Dahlonega area. And then a lot of the people from in Jasper, I think some moved to Tate, they came from it's a little over from Columbus, Georgia, like Phoenix City on that side.
Yeah, Alabama.
Yeah, Chambers County. I see a lot of people say that they're from Camp Hill, Alabama. And so some of the families from that are in Jasper, black families, come from Alabama, from down in that area near Columbus. But most families are from, like I said, from Dahlonega, Lumpkin County area, and from middle Georgia, from Washington County.
Do you have an impression why the marble industry would draw them, and were there better salaries? Was the social situation better? I mean, obviously in some cases you've talked about how it was, but do you know anything about those motivations?
I don't know anything specific, but I believe that's one of the main reasons they moved, because I don't think Washington County was necessarily, harsh, but it was, I don't think there were as many opportunities and down there. And I think maybe he probably did offer them a better salary, because I think a lot of them did work on cotton farms down there, and then some did work in the mines. And then I think, of course, Lumpkin County was largely agricultural also. So I think they just wanted a better opportunity, and they promised them that they'd have schools for them, and they would have a place. I guess they were fairly new at the time, new homes for them to live in. And so I believe that was the major factor for people moving from the areas they were recruited from.
And then in general, can you talk more about the community of Tate? Because I know that the Colonel Sam, you've sort of spoke about him and his relationship to the black community, but what about other whites, white laborers? Are they working alongside black laborers? Because in all the pictures, it's black laborers in one area and white laborers, and there's maybe one picture where you have the mule team, and there's the one black mule driver with seven white mule drivers. That's the only one I've seen where it's black and white working together. Can you talk about that?
See, I've never heard that there was, they worked on this side, or the blacks worked on one side. I've never heard, anything definite about that. Sounds like they kind of, work in close proximity, maybe. But, maybe they took pictures like that just for, the optics, to make everybody say.
That's exactly what my next question was. Was that just a promotional thing? We're not mixing. We've got jobs for both, but we're not mixing. I wonder if that was PR.
I think so. I think that was probably PR. But I do have a story from Mimi Joe Hill Butler that I think it was our little LJ telephone company. They started buying up everything, and they started to provide cable for everyone. And so they had their little local station, they started doing shows where they interview local citizens. So they interviewed Miss Weaver, Willie Mae Weaver, and there was an interview on there with people in Tate. And so they interviewed Miss Mimi Jo Butler, and she was telling a story about one day her father, I think it was J.B. Hill, was I guess he was the head. I don't know his official title. But
yeah, he did the tombstone design.
Yeah.
So.
And so she was taking him lunch. I guess that was back when they said back then people just walk in the quarry, walk around, no OSHA or anything like that. And so apparently Luke Tate fell in the quarry. And my grandpa, great grandma used to always say, he swam like a diving duck, that's what you say. And apparently he jumped in the quarry and brought Luke Tate up out of the quarry, and she said she just saw my grandpa was like a super scene from Superman, dive down and go get him out of the quarry and get him, rescue him from drowning. And so, and she's like, it was just like he was bringing him up like he was Superman, like he was just, she's like, I just always thought that was the coolest thing. And then she said, Jewel Hampton. I'm like, oh, that's my great-grandpa. And oh, so wow. Then I heard another man tell the same story, and so I was like, oh, that's cool.
Do you know anything about those Tate siblings, like Luke and Walter and Flora? Can you talk any stories you know about them?
Well, my great-grandmother on my Hampton, Jewel Hampton, said, and Ruby Hampton said, that's funny, Jewel Ruby, I never thought about it. And I think his name was actually Julian, I think. And so they were walking past the Tate house, and I've heard that Flora was kind of, you know, she was an old maid, and she was kind of mean, and said they just saw her pouring, I guess she had extra milk, didn't give it to anybody, just pouring it out the back door. And she said that always, you know, she's like, there are people around, you know, that need food and need milk, and she's just pouring it out and
wasting it.
I remember that story about her. And then I do remember a story, and I just feel like it kind of set the overtone, you know, how things kind of go in Tate. I don't know which servant it was or who it was working in the house, said one of the grandchildren of the Tate. So I don't know which Tate it was. If it might not, because, you know, Sam Tate, none of them had children, those right. three. And maybe it was a niece or nephew was holding a, I don't know if it was Sam Tate again, I don't know. Sounds like it might have been Sam Tate. He was holding a silver dollar in his hand, and he's like, he used another word. He used the N-word. It's like, never let an N-word have money or something to that effect. It sounded like a direct quote when I've heard the story. So maybe not let them, you know, have too much. I don't know what it is, but I was like, And then that makes me think of, and then people have, you know, how people, you know, just say everything's like, yeah, they said that the Tate said a black person will never own land in Pickens, well, in the Tate area. And that's been true. I don't think anyone's ever owned land in Tate. So.
But I mean, that's where most black residents have lived in Pickens County, is in and around Tate.
Right. And so nobody, you know, they've always lived in the company houses or in, like I said, in those apartments that the Jasper City Housing Authority built.
Do you know of people like trying to get a mortgage and buy a house and being refused?
I believe, I don't know any specific stories. I believe when the houses, you know, were in such disrepair, people, they built those apartments that maybe people were trying to maybe buy their the plot, like maybe acre or 2 acres that their home or half an acre that their home was on, but they wouldn't sell. But they were able to go. There were several people from Tate, and then the people in Nelson, they actually were able to buy their home and buy the land that their home is on. So,
were these white people?
No, the black people. The black
so people. In other parts of the county?
Yes, like in Nelson. Well, of course, Nelson's bisected by, so in North Cherokee and in Pickens there in Nelson. And then I think for years, I think people in Jasper were able to, there were several blacks that owned land, like Olin Collins moved to Jasper. His land is still there, still in the family. It's off South Main Street. And they built a house there. They had like maybe 10 acres. And now I think it's down to like maybe 5 or 6 acres. And so they bought land in Jasper. And then I think the McClures owned land in Jasper and a couple other families. But no one ever, black, has ever owned land in Tate.
I mean, that's interesting if we're talking about, like, Colonel Sam being this noble sort of benefactor for the black community, but still having that complete control. Mm-hmm. And so does he still fundamentally believe, and then his family members and other community members, like, well, we're going to be in charge, but I don't know, if the business ends, these people need to move on out. I mean, like, what do you think? You talked about the overtones. What are you talking about when you say that?
Well, I guess the overtone that, you know, hey, y'all, we can't ever buy a house or buy land to build a house in Tate. So I, but when the company, you know, the company did sell the homes that they owned of the white employees, they were all able to buy their homes, and they own their, most of them own those little craftsman bungalows up there in Tate, in and around the clinic, Tate Clinic and the cemetery. And so I guess they were able to buy, I think it was like maybe in the 50s. But then I've heard my grandma's great-grandma, Ruby, say that if they ever found marble on your land, on the land, even if you owned it, that means you were, they could kick you out. I'm like, even if they owned it? But of course, then, when the company owned everything, they owned it anyway, so.
I mean, what is, not to jump too far ahead, because there's still a lot I want to cover about the especially the 50s when the company was sold. Was it the 50s? Or the, when was the company sold?
I think it was probably the 50s.
Okay, because, I mean, I know there was a period at which some people were moving away. But, I mean, what is the legacy of that now? Like, what is the situation in Tate now for black residents who still live there? What is their impression of living there?
Well, like, they're still living on I guess the Tate Estates now owns the land that the people live. Like, the, I think there's, like I said, only two homes left in Smoky Hollow, and then that, the, I guess about, I guess they just know that they, you know, are able to live there and they don't actually own it. But I think they're, you know, there's nothing, you know, they're able to do what, you know, with it, whatever they want, maybe not build anymore or, you know, do anything drastic. But they, I guess it's just like business as usual. It just hasn't really changed in the fact that, you know, that they can live on this land, but they don't own it.
Do you know if they pay rent?
I'm not sure. I've always wondered that, too. I've never, you know, been like, do y'all pay?
Yeah. So let's talk about the 1950s, because it, you know, the company was at its height in the early 20th century. My impression from what I've seen, and I think in talks with Kelly, who's done a lot of the research, is that many black residents migrated out of certainly out of Tate, but many out of the county as well. Why was that, and where did they go?
I think a lot of it's because the company was declining, and I think it, I think I know that just because of the, before the church at Mount Calvary, we didn't have homecoming. I think that's the time they started having homecoming because so many people had started moving, so give them a chance to come back and see everybody, and we're actually having that Sunday coming up. And I think it started maybe the late 40s. People started moving away, and like to, a lot of people moved to like the Columbus area, Cincinnati, Ohio, and some people just moved as far away, close by as Tennessee, and then several people moved to Atlanta, and I think it was just because the marble industry was, you know, they didn't have, you know, the support system they had when the company was, you know, at its height, and maybe not the income, and maybe they were looking, I think they were looking for better opportunities, I think, because I think, of course, they still had the school, and I don't know, I don't know if this to be a fact, but from what I, you know, when I talk to people, I feel like when the company, Georgia Marble Company, the Tates, had something to do with, like, the school, that they had a more active role, and they actually put more into it than when the, than when Pickens County Schools took over, because I think they cut, like, I don't think they cut many teachers, but they didn't have many like special programs. I don't think they had music anymore and just like extra stuff like that. And when, of course, they had a really good basketball teams from what I hear, but they didn't. They built a new school, the Head Start, but they didn't build a gym for this good basketball team to play in. So, and actually, from I was talking with someone the other day, they said that this they only went to the old school, Pickens County Training School, like maybe a year when they were first or second grade. And it seems like it was so much bigger, like maybe four or five more classrooms. It was two levels, or maybe three. It had a big auditorium, and where when they built Tri-City, which is now Tri-City, the Head Start, it was smaller, and they had maybe, she says she remembers having like 2-3 grades in one room. She's like, it wasn't a big, you know, there was like the overcrowded, but it just seems like the school was like smaller. They made it much smaller than the old school, no auditorium, and then they didn't have a gym anyway. They didn't have, they didn't build a gym for them, and but it was a new school. I think they just built it just because, I think it was maybe 54, 55, like the governor, Talmadge, I don't know, maybe which Talmadge would it have been? Herman Talmadge, maybe?
And I know Eugene was dead in 48, yeah. So I think it'd be Herman.
Yeah, he was, you know, that was when schools were trying to integrate, and they
right.
actually...
They would build new schools,
yeah.
The equalization
yes,
schools.
Yes. And so to say, okay, you know, we got they've got a new school, so they won't have a reason to say, oh, our school's not up to par, so we don't really care if we would, you know, go to the white school or whatever.
So they tore down the wooden school yes. to build this newer school that was inadequate to meet the needs of the
well, I think
sports, academics, I mean, the whole range of things.
Well, I think it met the very, like you said,
basic.
Basic needs.
Yeah. Okay, so that was Tri-City, and so that was only in operation then for...
10 years.
10 years. So can you walk me through integration, what you know of that, how that played out?
Well, from what I know, that Miss Lila Brown was the principal, and I think the school board approached her about choosing some of the students she thought would do well, a couple students she thought would do well, like a year before they decided to fully integrate. So I think she chose maybe 5 or 6 students, and then they were, you know, to send to Tate Elementary. Well, I think it was just in Jasper, the students from Jasper. And so they went to the Jasper Elementary and to Pickens High School. And then I think all the students in Jasper had to go to school up there. And then eventually I think they moved everybody in by 67, 68.
Do you know any of those first kids that were selected?
Yes. Karen was. She was in second or third grade, Karen McClure Benson. And then Sandra Collins is the one I worked for. And that's one of Olin Collins' granddaughters. And then the grandson, Michael Collins. I think she was in second or third grade, and Michael was like in, I think he was almost maybe 11th, 10th or 11th grade, and then, let's see, who else? One of my neighbors, I think. Then along the elementary, Stephanie Pitts. There were several, and I can't think of all of their names.
You've just named like 6. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, what was the reception of them?
Well, they said there were little things, Karen. I always tell the story, she was our Sunday school teacher, about remembering a little boy was like, is your blood red? And little things like that. And I don't think there was anything big. And I remember, I think it was Michael Collins. He was in Kathy Thompson's. She interviewed him and his mom, Emma Julia, and was just saying that it was just a pretty smooth transition, you know, besides little things, you know, there weren't students out in the hall and teachers out in the hall calling them names and throwing stuff. Said they had a, I think they said they remember there was a police guard first day just to, you know, when they got off the bus, and then they went in and just went to class and said it was pretty normal. Then, and then from there, I think after that, there was full integration, but nothing big. And it was just a smooth transition, I think.
Had there been, you know, we've done some work in Marietta, and the church there, the Zion Baptist Church, there were members and a reverend there, a pastor there in the 60s who, like, wrote a letter to the school board and said, we would like to see, you know, integration, and if not that, better textbooks, you know. Do you know of any efforts there in Tate prior to, on the side of the Black community, to push for that? Or what were the feelings about? Were people wanting that, or were they leery of that?
I've heard from both sides, kind of. I've heard a member of, when I was the music director at Tate Methodist, and one of the members, I think his name was, I can't remember his name, Brad White, that's his name. He was saying that he heard this, he was in school at the time, he was in high school, he heard that a lot of the blacks said they didn't mind, they wanted to, they liked where they were and, you know, really didn't want to integrate, you know, didn't mind either way. And then on the black side, I heard that they kind of would rather stay at their school anyway and finish, you know, and just because they liked their environment, they liked the teachers, and they liked kind of, they felt like they were getting a, you know, they knew what, you know, what they only knew about what they were getting there. They knew that they were getting hand-me-down textbooks, but they felt like, you know, that they liked their school and they didn't really, you know, they didn't, they weren't like, you know, adamantly opposed, but they were fine with, excuse me, going to Tri-City and not integrating. So I don't think there weren't any efforts from our pastor. I think they just helped with the transition when it arose. And our pastor at the time, he was there for like 20 years. And I think about him now because of all the stuff going on with the Southern Baptist Convention. He actually worked in the Southern Baptist Convention. He left Mount Calvary to be the director of black relations for the Georgia Baptist Convention, which is, you know, an extension of the Southern Baptist Convention.
The director of what?
Black relations.
And what was his name?
His name was Edward Davey.
And you're saying he was pastor in like
from 59 into like 81 or something like that.
Is he living?
No, he passed away in the 80s, I think.
You know, the schools are always like the clearest example of where integration took place. But do you know of, you know, businesses allowing black customers? Like, when was that happening? Or, you know, maybe they allowed black customers, but when was this sort of equal treatment enforced or seen?
Well, I'd heard about, I think, pretty much in the, I've never heard anybody saying that they had to go in a different door or anything in the stores and tape. So I think they, I think it was kind of just understood, like, you know, with the Tate, they talk about the Tate drugstore, that you didn't eat at the counter. I've never seen any pictures or heard anybody say that there were signs, you know, colored here and that. I just think they were able to go in and get their food and Tate and just, and maybe leave, or maybe they had a spot for them to eat. I'm not sure, but I've heard of examples in Jasper, like with the theater. The door, I thought about it the other day. We went to this restaurant, it's called 61 Main. It used to be the theater, and there's this little door. Now I think it's like a hair salon, and I'm like, I bet that was the colored entrance to go up to the balcony for the theater. And I asked someone, and like, it was. And then they said in the hospital, it was like right next to, it was right on Main Street at the time. It was called Roper Hospital, ran by the Roper family. And mostly there were three or four rooms blocked off in the basement. They weren't, you know, didn't have a sign, but you know, that's where when women had babies, they would mostly be in that room down in the basement, those set of rooms. And then there was the most vivid example I remember hearing about is this restaurant. It was called Champions Restaurant. It was in downtown Jasper. And they had a place where, I guess that was one of the bigger restaurants, you could eat in the kitchen. They had a little spot, two or three tables where you could eat in the kitchen, but you had to go in the back door to be served. But they said most people just went there and got the food and went home.
So I know, you know, you were born in the late 80s. Do you remember any situations in which you faced racism?
Nothing, you know, big, just little, you know, name calling back and forth. And the biggest thing I remember is there were these, I think they still make them ridiculous, Dixie Outfitter shirts. And I think there was a big thing. I think Cherokee had a rougher time with integration and stuff like that, the Pickens County. But during this time, I just remember one student wore one of the Dixie Outfitter shirts, and it had black people on the back picking cotton or something like that. And there was a scuffle, and that's the only thing I remember that's kind of, you know, been like a school-wide thing, people talking about it. But other than little name-calling things and, you know, little scuffles about that, nothing, you know, nothing really sticks out. Except, I take that back. Now that people have been, they were talking about, what's the prince? Prince married?
Harry?
Did he marry Meghan Markle?
Yeah, Prince.
And talking about skin color, I remember one of the students, she was a student leader in the band, and I, for some reason, they didn't have it for a day, and I, you know, in my little eighth grade mind, going to ninth grade, I was so excited, I missed the whole next week, but even though it was just one day, I didn't miss, and so I was late, so I didn't get to know anybody. She was like, are you from here? You're darker than the rest of the blacks around here. I'm like, what, are you from South Georgia? And I was like, no. I was like, you know, I didn't think, I was just like, oh, you know. And then now that I think about it, I'm like, that was kind of bad.
Yeah.
Kind of terrible.
You just out of the blue?
Out of the blue, you know.
And you were in eighth grade at the time?
Well, I was ninth grade. Right,
okay.
Entering into ninth grade.
So that was like 2001?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wow.
And then, I just kind of, I didn't talk to them anymore. Like, they were sitting behind me, and they were talking about, I don't think it was Martin Luther King Day, but it was before Martin Luther, it was something about Martin Luther King in our morning announcements. And one of these people, I thought they were my friends, they were like, the principal made a quote or said something about Martin Luther King, and somebody's like, well, who cares about Martin Luther King? And the other kid, like, well, I guess black people. I was like, well, we do, and you should probably too. And so, just little things like that, nothing big. And I guess, you know, things I've heard about with race really didn't hit until I moved in college and people were talking about different things that they had experienced. And I was like, oh, okay. I'm like, I'm from little Pickens County, one of the only black people in Pickens County. And, you know, and we didn't have problems like this. And, you know, just seeing from both sides where the... there was an influx of black students at Shorter College at the time. They had just started some new athletic programs and different programs, and it drew more, you know, more diverse population. And it was just like, they're like, it's kind of a them, not, it wasn't a really them versus us versus them, but you could just see some division. They were like, well, why? Music department, you know, it was mostly girls, and they were mostly white, and they're like, why are you? You know, I was just sitting with people, you know. I didn't know I was supposed to sit with just the black people, or you know. And they were like, well, why don't you hang out with us more often? You know, and they've done this, and I've seen this, and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh. And then seeing, you know, some of the white students that were kind of, you know, you could tell that they were maybe prejudiced or maybe not necessarily racist, and they would make little comments. I'm like, I'm not used to that.
Well, I mean, you know, that's a question that sort of lingered in my mind is the fact that it is a very small population of people of color, period, in Pickens. And, you know, do you know people, say, in or have family members or friends in Cobb County or in Fulton County where there's a, you know, larger population of people who aren't white? I mean, where it's a different experience, or you've ever sort of thought about that or talked about that?
We've had some of that, and then I have family, and some of the blacks moved to Detroit, and a lot of my family did, and they were just like, I need to come out of those woods, and they'd come down, and they would say, where are the black people? I'm like, y'all moved away, but some of them just, I guess, you know, they said they're just not used to seeing so many whites at once, or going, they're like, we go to school with them, and we're, you know, pretty much cordial to each other, go to each other's houses and things like that. And they were just like, that's just strange to us. And I'm like, okay.
Did you ever visit?
Seems like people mostly visited us.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't interrupt.
So we never really, everybody, I guess, they would come to see my great-grandmother, and so we never really visited, you know, like going to see people in Cobb or mostly in Atlanta. One of my uncles, great uncles, lived in Atlanta. They would always come up here. We did go down there once, but you know, it was just, you know, maybe once or twice, and you know, we just played, you know, and so. But yeah, that was the biggest thing they noticed. Of course, the population difference, and they were just like, "We're not used to that."
Yeah.
You know.
Let me check my time to make sure we're not... oh, no, we're good. So I just want to, for the as we move towards the finish, I want to talk about the churches in Smoky Hollow and learn a little bit about those, and then we'll finish up learning about your education, graduate education, and career. Can you tell me about the churches in Smoky Hollow, their history up to today, and just sort of a general history?
Well, I'll start with one I know the least about, which is the Church of Smoky Hollow. I never knew the name, like, before. Like, I knew that they had a little sign out there called, you know, when it was called Miracle Fellowship Holiness Church, but I'd always heard it had been, they'd say, the Methodist Church, or the Church of Smoky Hollow. And I never knew. It was built, I did know it, they were all, I think, Tate Methodist, and then Church of Smoky Hollow and Mount Calvary were all kind of built at the same time, and in the histories, you know, that and articles that they all kind of helped each other build the churches, and that while, you know, there were fewer Methodists, Black Methodists in the Tate area than there were Baptists, and so I think, of course, that's how our church has kind of kept going for since 1886, 87, when those churches started being built, and that they would go to church down there on the second Sunday, and Mount Calvary had church the third Sunday, and then they would travel to Jasper to Friendship Church on first Sunday, and then the fourth Sunday they would go to the church in Nelson, Pilgrim Baptist Church, and I always hear the name Reverend Curtis, that he was one of the pastors. He tried to keep the church going, but, you know, people started moving. And he would come, I think they said he would have service a little later because I think he was the pastor. Actually, he was the pastor at the AME church in Canton, St. Paul AME. And so he tried to keep the church going as long as he could. And then I don't think it was for as long as people say, like the 40s, because I talked to people that weren't, they might have been born in the 40s. But, you know, they remember actually going, it must have been in the 50s, you know, going to church with Reverend Curtis having leading services down there. And they would remember that there'd be more people from other churches than the Methodist. And then when he stopped coming, that's when, like, the Holiness Pentecostals started coming in from Marietta to have service. And then there's an article, I think Kathy did it, or some Kathy Thompson or someone did it, about they interviewed Sister Mamie Moss, Pastor Mamie Moss. She was the pastor down there about, I guess, it was in maybe the late 50s, early 60s. She had a vision. She said she had a vision of a church with checkerboard windows. They used to have red checkerboard windows, red and white. And then she came up with a group of people that were having service in there, and she said, this is the church. And she started having services down there and got different people in the community to donate different things to help build, like, the pulpit and things like that. And people would go down there, and she had a, you know, kind of smaller congregation than the other churches, but they would have service, you know, more, you know, Pentecostal-type holiness services, and people from the different churches would visit down there. And so I think that went on. I'm not quite sure when her husband passed away or something, so she moved. I'm not quite sure where she moved, maybe North Carolina or Texas. I don't know why that sticks out in my mind. But then maybe the early 2000s, she moved back to Pickens County, and she, for several years, she had service, and maybe and people would go down, and she'd have service, and she actually lived. She would come by because she knew my great-grandmother. I think she would go down there to the service, and she'd come, and they'd talk, and she'd call her, and she would, my grandma didn't go to the Senior Citizen Center, but she did, and the lady I mentioned earlier, Miss Hazel Buck, they would go to the Senior Citizen Center, and I don't think I've ever been in the church. I think I peeked in when I was down there at my grandma's. We went up there and peeked in, and so that's as much as I know about Miracle Fellowship or Mount Tabor. I believe that's what Miss Weaver said the name was. We had Mount Calvary and then Mount Tabor, AME.
What was it? What's the condition now?
It's pretty bad. Pretty bad. Someone actually sent a picture, and it looks like the window is falling out. They're trying to get it on the
National Register.
Yes, but the like places in
peril from and, Georgia Trust.
Yes, but then there's another one. Like they just go around taking pictures of rural churches.
Mm-hmm.
A lady emailed Kathy Thompson about it, and she sent the email. Oh, I guess I didn't send that email to you when you said where to come to. Oh, I thought I sent that. But anyway, and where is that? But it's in pretty bad shape. It's in bad shape. And then with Mount Calvary, it was actually, I think Miss Weaver wrote this article, was saying that, you know, the Tate family, they were all Methodists. That's why Tate Methodist, and they were so involved with Tate Methodist Church because Sam Tate's brother-in-law was a Methodist pastor, so he built the church for him. And then he built Mount Calvary for his chauffeur, well, no, butler, his valet. His name was... it's in some of the the story goes, Sam Tate was, you know, he was never married. He was kind of a philanderer, so to speak. And they said he got in a kind of a, I don't know if it's bar room. That's what I think that's a term I've seen. A fight with someone's, I think it was a husband of a lady, one of his lady friends. And he... sliced his neck, and Mimi Jo pointed this out in something she was, maybe that interview that he, after that, he all of his pictures, he was wearing an ascot. He always had an ascot on, or a scarf or something. And
The other guy?
No, Sam Tate.
But Sam Tate got his neck sliced.
Yes.
Oh.
And my, and his valet, Jeff Strickland, which I think he's maybe a great uncle of mine, I believe, if I read that right. And he was his valet, said he was a big guy, he was maybe over 6 foot tall, and he, the guy said, the quarrel's not with you, so he kind of moved him out of the way, and that's when he slit Sam Tate's throat, and but I think he was able to get him where he needed to, and he's credited with saving Sam Tate's life, and so he was always very close with Sam Tate, and so he built, since he knew that he was Baptist, he asked for a Baptist church to be built because I think most of them, they would all have, I think it was, you know, since Sam Tate, you know, their family was Methodist, the services were more Methodist. And so so they built, he asked for Mount Calvary to be built, a church for the Baptist. And then they built the church for, there was probably some relation or something. I think I've heard the name, it was like Josh Tate or something. And, he was one of the leaders in the Methodist Church, AME Church. And so, and then Mount Calvary, I think roughly 1886, and goes on, and we've had, the church was actually on the opposite side of the road near the railroad tracks coming up from in the holler. And it was actually bombed or dynamited by the vigilantes. They don't necessarily say the Klan, but they say white cappers. I guess I don't know if that's another name for the Klan. And while Sam Tate was out of the country in Europe looking at new projects, and I think it's documented, it's in Kathy Thompson's articles, that is documented that in the Atlanta Constitution or the Atlanta Journal, that this happened, that the black citizens of Tate were being terrorized by a group of vigilantes in like the early, like maybe, I think it was like maybe 1905 or somewhere in the early 1900s. And so they bombed, they dynamited some of the houses, the workers' houses and the church. And then there was a school right next to it. There was the church and then the school. And then the new church, the church we're in now, I think it was built maybe 1910 by one of the pastors that was a pastor for Mount Calvary. And I think he had been the pastor at Friendship also, but he built the church and so in its present location. And then from there, just the church has had, you know, been, it was very active in the convention, the National Baptist Convention. And I think it had some ties with the Southern Baptist Convention too, but probably mostly the National Baptist Convention being, and the different, you know, the Baptist churches that have the association, the Black Association, actually, it's called Kennesaw. It's called the Kennesaw Association. It's still called that, the Kennesaw Baptist Association. And our church would, for many years, was a part of the association. Now we're kind of more independent. And
why is that?
One of our pastors, he didn't like some of the things that were going on with the convention. He felt like they weren't addressing social issues and were kind of standoffish, and we just kind of followed his lead. Because before him, there wasn't anything going on. But then before that, Reverend Davey, the one I mentioned, Edward Davey, he was heavily involved, and they would go and participate in different convention activities and send delegates and to the different meetings of the Kennesaw Association. But after that, kind of fell off, and then they talked about getting into it again. And the pastor at the time, Reverend Leland Jones, he didn't really, you know, like being involved with it, so we just followed his lead, and, you know, we still don't really participate with anything with the association, the Kennesaw Association.
So you talked about Miracle Fellowship being more Pentecostal. What was Calvary style of service?
Well, my great grandma, she was more charismatic than a lot of people. I think at the time, people, you know, you think of people, especially in Black churches, talking back to the preacher, saying amen. She said, not in Malachi. She's like, I was kind of disappointed. But she said she would say amen, and everybody looked and said, yeah, I remember your grandma. Yeah, she's short. She gave am. I'm like, what's that mean? She's like, yep, I gave am all the time to the preacher. Said, I think the preachers were pretty charismatic, but as far as they said some people, they wouldn't talk back to the preacher. They said a couple people would shout. But it was more, I think I've seen a program, I wish I still had it, so we could put it in the collection, from like 1940-something. And the service was very formal, I think a lot of that had to do since it was right there, and most of the teachers attended church there. I think, they helped shape the service to be more formal, and, you know, there was singing of hymns and the doxology and the whatever, the Gloria, Patri, and stuff like that. Very formal. I'm like, yeah, Tate. And now we've kind of strayed from that. We still sing hymns, whereas some churches, like in Pilgrim, they just had a great gospel choir, and our choir was more like, you know, more, I think they're more traditional, and I think all of the churches, you know, back in the days when people were singing schools, like I believe the people, that would come and teach in Pickens County and North Cherokee were from Cartersville area, and they'd have a singing school, and you know, they, and I think that still had a lot of influence, you know, singing those shake note songs, those old songs like that, and four-part harmony, whereas, you know, more other churches were moving toward, you know, gospel music. And
how do you think that's impacted the church in recent times? Like, is it held back its growth? How often do you meet? What's going on with the church now?
Well, the church now, we meet twice a month now. It's weird because most churches is either first and third or second and fourth that meet like that. Well, we're second and third. And still that influence of the Church of Smoky Hollow meeting on second Sunday. So none of our other three churches in our little community have church on second Sunday. So each church started having services on the Sunday that they had been designated. The third Sunday was ours, and then second Sunday. So second and third. And we've kind of, like in the early 2000s, you see with the pictures that there were a lot of young people, and they were, you know, starting to see, like, and we're starting to see and hear a lot of things that, you know, current stuff, current music and current worship styles, but it still pretty much stayed, you know, still in line with the order of service that we'd always had. And so I think it was, you know, I don't think it really, some people that were, that, you know, we started seeing other people from like Canton come in and Marietta, they'd come to church up here. They didn't necessarily have any family ties. Well, they did have family ties, so that's why they started coming to church. You know, some of them were like, oh, we don't like this style of worship, and we need to move. You know, it wasn't much of it, but, you know, there was a little bit. And I think, you know, it didn't have a huge bearing on our numbers now, but I think what's had a impact on our numbers now is more, I don't know, not necessarily our style of worship and, you know, style of doing things, but I think it's just more people have moved away, and then some people, you know, church attendance is down anyway for even large churches.
How many people per the second and third Sunday?
Oh, my goodness. This Sunday, that's because we had a baptism. There was about maybe 30 people, and on home, probably we'll probably have over 100 or 150. Used to have probably like more 200, 300 on a homecoming Sunday, but on the second Sunday, maybe 20, 30 people, and then the third Sunday, our main Sunday, we'd have maybe 50 to 75, but now it's probably like maybe 20, sometimes less. It's been less, but even before the pandemic, it was less. We looked at, there's only like 5 people out there.
And what's the ratio of like local people to out-of-towners coming?
It's pretty equal now. It used to be a little more, with more people coming out from out of town that have moved, like to Kennesaw down here and moved to Atlanta. They would come back. You know, they'd go to churches around here on the other two Sundays or other three Sundays, and then they come on the third Sunday. So it used to be there were more people coming from other places other than Pickens and locally.
I see. Well, to finish up, let's talk about your high school and college career. You graduated from Pickens County High School?
Yes.
And what year was that?
2005.
And where did you go to college?
I went to Shorter College of 2005 until 2009, and I majored in music. I did piano pedagogy, and that's going back to the church. One Sunday I said, well, I guess it was a choir rehearsal. I said, it was Miss Weaver. She had self-taught herself how to play piano. She played for all the youth activities and for the children. And so she's like, well, who's going to take over? She's probably 80 then, you couldn't tell, or 82, something like that. And she's like, well, who's going to take over when I retire? And I said, well, why can't I? She's like, okay, we'll start you with piano lessons. And so she calls Bill Cagle's wife, and she's like, we have a student here who's going to take piano. And she's like, I was like, I guess I can try it. And I started, and they saw I was progressing, and I liked what I was doing, and I guess I had some musical talent, and so I kept taking. And then I took, she had to, I think Bill or somebody in the family had a work-related injury, and so she couldn't, she didn't have anyone to keep her young children. They're like 20, 25 now. And so she had to stop teaching private lessons for a while. And so I started, just took a little while off. And then our church pianist, who is, we've seen pictures of, she doesn't ever, I don't know why she does, great picture. She's very photogenic, but she's not any of our current pictures. She was our church pianist for the main Sunday, the third Sunday. Marianne Roach, her husband, was Preston Roach. Mm-hmm. And then there's Truman and, you know, the trio. And then Karen's dad, and she actually helped get them, you know, kind of coached them along. But she taught me for a couple years, and she was like, well, I think he's about past me. She was a person that, you know, took lessons, and she played in church, and she did really well, but she, you know, she always felt like, you know, I'm not a professional, you know, musician. And so she passed me along to the one teacher. She was really good. She moved on because her husband passed away, Jan Moody. And then I took, before, during high school, I took from a lady named Patty Adams, and she started me, you know, working on, you know, I'd learned how to play hymns and certain music, but, you know, working on music that it would take if I decided to major in music. And so I did that, and I was like, well, I get to Shorter College, maybe I'll major in music. So I took lessons, and I took some of the music classes that the other freshmen were taking, and then I applied to for entry into the music program. I'm like, if I get in, I'll major in music, and if I don't, I'll just maybe minor. But I got in, and so I did music education, well, not music education, piano pedagogy. And then I said, I don't know what I could do with this except teach piano at home, and that doesn't really work. Unless you're an old lady with a husband that's a doctor or makes a lot of money. And so I'm like, I'm not. And so I went to Reinhardt and got my music education courses and got a music education degree and my certification 2000 from August 2009 to December 2010, did student teaching at Etowah High School in Woodstock. And then I was a substitute teacher. Seems like it was forever. It was only 2 or 3 years in Pickens County and in Cherokee County. And then I was hired to teach chorus and assist with the band at Lithia Springs High School. And that was a real culture shock. Well, not really a culture shock, just the kids were just, whew. But anyway, so I taught there. Like, I have a full year of credit. I only think about my retirement years for teaching there, a full year, because I was there until March, and then I was like, maybe I should look else. Then I subbed for a while, then I worked part-time as a music teacher at the Murphy Harps Children's Home in Cedartown. And then I got a call, I don't even remember applying at a school in Savannah, and they called me, would you like an interview, Mr. Dennis? I'm like, for what? The music teacher, won't you be our band and chorus teacher? And so I was like, okay, I'll come interview. So I took a day off from the academy at Murphy Harps, and I went down at, it's called Woodville Tompkins High School. Well, it was career, technical and career high school, and it was like their school where they used to send, they go to school at their regular high school and then come to Woodville for the vocational classes. But then they turned it back into a full high school where they had all the programs and that they could attend there. And so I started the band and chorus, and I did that for 3 years, and then I guess now it's almost 3 years ago, I moved back to Jasper and got a job teaching elementary music at Cloverleaf Elementary in Bartow County. And during the time I was doing all the substituting and starting out, I was getting my master's also, so I got my master's in music education at Reinhardt also.
Well, why did you choose, did you seek to return to Pickens?
Well, I was thinking about it because while the school I was at in Savannah was very, it was a very good for their school system. They have, it's a really big school system. I think that's part of their issue. Instead of having like some places around, have the county, then the city school system. Well, it's all one. There's 12 high schools, and I just feel like it was just, they wanted the music program, but they didn't give me the resources I needed to actually make it a viable part of the curriculum. And so I was like, maybe I should look elsewhere. And so it kind of just, again, fell in my lap. And they were like, we saw your application. Well, no, it was actually a music friend from Shorter. He had been in the reserves, and he was about 40, and he said his wife was a music teacher at the school I'm at before I got there, and she was leaving to come. She was in Cobb. Now, I think she came back to Cobb to, before retirement. And he's like, your name just came across the principal's desk at Cloverleaf Elementary. Look for a call. I'm like, okay. So she liked my references. She's like, you've got really good references, and would you come up for an interview? So I did, and I went to an interview in, on the same day up in Chattooga County, Tryon City Schools. And so got the job at Cloverleaf, and so I was like, well, I guess I'll move back. I guess that's my sign. I need to move back north. And so I did, and so here I am now.
Do you envision yourself ever, would you be willing or would you be open to moving from Pickens?
I thought about it. I don't know. I feel like right now it's a good place to be, to live. One day I'd maybe work for the school system. I don't know. Just because with my job teaching music, music teacher gets in a spot unless they, don't like it. If they really like it, they stay there until they're done. 30 years, they're 30 years there. And, there are fewer positions. So if, I got an offer somewhere else, not too far. I just don't want to go all the way to South Georgia again. But I don't know. I would think about it. But I, you know, for right now, I think I would, you know, like my situation now, live Pickens County, maybe commute maybe an hour, because right now it's probably like 40 minutes, but no more than an hour.
How is it different from the place you grew up, Pickens County? Has it changed in any remarkable way, other than like population growth and?
I would say it's changed a little bit in regards, to, of course, population, but I feel like it's a little more. I don't know. I can't think of the word. It's a little more. Less doesn't have the home feeling, I guess, anymore. I feel like it's kind of moving away where you know everyone, and I feel like the people that have come in, they're not trying to, you know, of course they want to be involved with their community. They don't really understand, you know, the dynamics in Pickens County, how we didn't have, like, with race, we didn't have the problems just because our population was smaller. In my mind, I always, in the back of my mind, I'm like, if we had a bigger population, I feel like it would have been different. I feel like they would have been like, oh, you know, how things were done to keep people in control. I think more of that would have been done. Of course, none of that was ever really had to be done in Pickens County. So I think it would have been different if we had a bigger population of blacks in Pickens County.
And are you involved in local initiatives to save Black history?
I'm currently on the, I guess the county has a board set aside for the for the restoration of the Tate Depot, and so I've been asked to be on that board, so I'm on that board, and I feel like they were saying, you know, from there, the John Anderson, who is the executive over that, he's wanting to go from there to help restore the the church in Smoky Hollow and help put that on the registry, the historical registry, and Mount Calvary. And so I think that's one small part I'm playing, just to help keep to help with making sure we get those things on the historical registry.
Are there any other stories or memories you'd like to share?
Let's see. Not that I can think of right now.
Well, I appreciate it. This has been a great interview.
Thank you.
And I think we'll conclude there.